So welcome everybody. This is our first workshop for Kilche 2018. As we, as you all know, our theme for this Kilche is about Korean Buddhism, how Korean Buddhism came about, what the teachings are. If you've been around for a while, you already know the teachings because that's what we do here. But since Korean Zen is not particularly well known among a wide population, we thought it would be really great to just shine a light on it. So maybe some of that is a little bit clearer than it has been before. We are going to go through, in a sense, the history of Korean Buddhism, but I certainly quickly came to the conclusion that most people don't want to hear 3 months about history, dates, names, places like that. So if you're disappointed, I urge you to dig deeply on your own. It would be very appreciated. Tonight, I'm going to talk about, just give a quick overview, and I'm going to talk about early Korean Buddhism through a single, probably certainly the first great mind of Korean Buddhism. I thought it would be more interesting to talk about that and try to connect it to the teachings that you're familiar with, or you're going to be more and more familiar with as you continue to practice. So before I get into Won Hyo, the star of tonight's show, I'm going to try to give you a really, really quick, high-altitude glimpse of what we are and how Buddhism got from India to Korea. I'm going to try to do that in about 5 minutes. So drink your imaginary cup of coffee and bear with me here. So first, we have a few people who haven't been here for very long, and maybe some of you have never really thought about it, so I'm going to say a couple of obvious, at least obvious to some of us, things first. When most people hear the word Zen, they think of Japanese Zen, because Japanese Zen has become such a kind of an iconic, the Japanese culture and Zen are so completely intertwined. But we're Korean Zen. We're a Korean Zen center. So the word Zen, if you don't know this already, just means meditation in Japanese. In India, it's called jhana. In China, it's called chan. In Korea, it's called sun. So the same word in different languages. So technically, we're a Korean Sun Center, but nobody knows what Sun is. So I think from the very beginning, when Zen Master Sung San brought his teaching to the United States, it's been called Zen from the very beginning. A little bit like, you know, we call our tissues Kleenexes. So everybody knows what Kleenex is. Everybody knows what Zen is. All right? So enough about that. Zen is a branch of Buddhism. Shakyamuni Buddha started teaching Buddhism in India. It spread all throughout Asia, and a number of branches on the tree of Buddhism spread out. So there are a number of different practices, as you probably know, and Zen is one of them, that emphasizes meditation. So quickly, how did Buddhism come from India into Korea? Buddhism initially spread from India all through Asia, mainly along trade routes. The most famous one in the north is the Silk Road between Central Asia and India into China. And it also, there are some other trade routes that spread through Southern Asia, and also sea routes. People went by ship. Primarily, the way it spread was monks monastics traveling from one place to the other, either because they wanted to spread Buddhism as missionaries, or later, particularly, monks would travel great distances so they could practice and study under enlightened masters. And when they did that, some through monastics, but also just through these trade routes, Buddhist sutras and other texts also travel along these trade routes. So when these sutras and texts were brought into new countries, of course, they had to be translated. Buddhism has always had the ability to kind of keep the central core of the teaching intact, even when it goes from one culture to another culture. But it also has a way to adapt to those individual cultures. So each culture, each country now, what we now think of them as countries, at the time they were little pockets of kingdoms and things like that. But each one has developed its own flavor. One example of this is just between India and China, vast differences in language, vast differences in terms of their cultural ideas, their worldviews, and very, very different cultures. So when Buddhist texts were brought along the Silk Road from India into China, translators had, in many ways, had no way of directly translating these things. Not only words, but ideas of Indian Buddhism were really foreign to people in China. So one of the ways that Buddhism changed when it went into China was these translators and teachers had to find existing Chinese ideas that everybody understood as a way to understand Buddhism. As a result, Taoism, which was a long-standing practice in China and was well-known, and Confucianism were folded in to Buddhism when it went from India to China. In the same way, Chinese Buddhism changed when it went into Korea. I'm going to tell you about this in a little bit of a different way. China is a huge, huge country. Huge country. The Korean Peninsula is very, very small. So in China, because of its size, many temples, which were scattered in areas that quite often were very distant from one another, would focus their teaching, for example, in a single temple around one sutra. So, and certain teachers who were schooled in these sutras taught from those sutras as their teachers. So you'll have a temple in one part of China that follows, say, just the Lankavatara Sutra. You have another temple or teacher that is using the Lotus Sutra. So many, many different schools of Buddhism evolved in China, partly because it's such a big country and it had the ability to accommodate all these different ways the tradition evolved. In contrast, we have this tiny, tiny peninsula in Korea. It was completely impossible for Korean Buddhism to accommodate all these different schools. So one of the results of Buddhism when it went into Korea is they synthesized a lot of these teachings and formed a very unified version of Buddhism. So Korean Buddhism owes a great debt and inherited the core teaching from Chinese Buddhism, but it also evolved into its own particular strand of Buddhism. Actually, in fact, to this very day, there is a single order monastic order in Korea. It's called the Choge order. So whether you're a Zen monastic or study sutras or something else, they're all part of this Choge order. That was important for a couple of reasons. Actually, when Buddhism came into Korea, it was transitioning from a number of kind of feudal states with tiny fiefdoms, and when it unified into first three kingdoms and then a unified kingdom, those rulers in those kingdoms needed to use everything they could to try to bring everybody into the fold. Okay, so there was a lot of shamanistic practice, a lot of folk religions in Korea. There still are, actually. But a lot of the rulers used Buddhism as a way to unify, to help unify everybody and bring the population together kind of in one culture, in one country. So that order is called the Choge order. If you see a Korean nun or monk, they're Choge nuns or monks. And fun little fact, Choge is actually the name of the mountain in China where Huineng, the sixth patriarch, lived and taught. So there's a very strong connection between Chinese, the history of Chinese Buddhism and Korea. I'm going to give you a quick timeline. I'm only going to give you two dates, and it's only for one purpose. Buddhism first appeared in Korea from China in the late 300s, 372. I do not know why they know it's 372. You're more than welcome. I assume it probably was maybe a missionary or some kind of event that happened, but 372. Part of the reason I'm telling this is, again, this assumption that Zen actually started in Japan. So Chan started in China, went to Korea first. And Buddhism in general started in the 300s. And Mahayana Buddhism was introduced to Japan from Korea in the mid 500s AD. So that's, I'm just bringing that up to see, so you know that Korean Buddhism actually has a very key place in the history of Asian Buddhism. Okay? End of our formal history. Who I really want to talk about is this really brilliant mind of early Korean Buddhism. If you read Zen Master Sung San's books, I believe you will only hear his name once. In Dropping Ashes on the Buddha, there's a chapter called The Story of Wan Hyo. Unless I'm missing something, I don't recall hearing about him elsewhere in our teachings. But he is one of the, not only one of the great minds of Korean Buddhism, he is one of the great minds of Asian Buddhism. He was considered one of the foremost Buddhist thinkers of his time, and his influence went back to China. Very, very well respected. He is also one of the most eccentric characters you will come across in the history of Buddhism, and there are more than one eccentric characters, especially in our Zen lineage. And I'll get to that later just because I couldn't resist. The story, so Wan Hyo lived in the 7th century, so the 600s in Korea. He was a monk, and this is, just to place it in a timeline, this is roughly the same time that Huineng, the sixth patriarch, the famous sixth patriarch, was living and teaching in China. So he's a contemporary. This is also during the Chinese Tang Dynasty, which is considered the golden age of Zen in China. So there's this brilliant young monk named Wan Hyo, and like many bright monastics of his time, it was kind of considered the ultimate learning experience to travel to China and study under an authentic master, and then bring the training that you received back to the local area. I can also tell you that wasn't just a one-way proposition. There were many. Once Buddhism and Zen really took hold in Korea, there were many, many Chinese monastics that came to Korea, studied under Korean masters, and came back to China. So it was really a cross-pollination. It didn't have as much to do with, as we think, one country and another. They were really traveling and learning from masters, okay? So, and this is also the way Buddhism spread through Asia. So Wan Hyo decided as a young monk that he wanted to go to China. Dropping ashes on the Buddha makes it sound like he had a backpack on his back and he was marching for weeks and weeks and weeks through the desert. In fact, from what I've read, he went to a port city and he was waiting for a ship to take him to China. But in any case, he was stuck as night fell in an absolutely torrential rainstorm. He had no, and the ship was not ready to leave. You know, the seas were too stormy, so the ship didn't leave port. So he was stuck overnight in torrential rains without a place to sleep. He finally found a place. He finally found shelter in a cave. And in the middle of the night, he woke up overcome with thirst. In the pitch black darkness, he crawled around looking for something to drink. And lo and behold, he found a gourd filled with water. He lifted it up to his lips, drank deeply from this water, felt incredibly refreshed, and went back to sleep. The next morning, he woke up feeling fresh, looked around him, trying to find that gourd of water again, and realized that the cave was actually a very rudimentary burial ground. And the gourd that he drank from was a cracked human skull covered with rotting flesh. And the water was brackish water filled with maggots. He immediately threw up. Wouldn't you? But at the same time, he had this huge opening, huge enlightenment experience. So what did he attain? Anybody brave enough to offer a thought about that? Well, okay, true. Very good. So this awakening part of it, this awakening part of it, what did he see? He saw something very clearly. I'll keep moving on. Are you still thinking? Adam? Okay.
Wet is wet.
So, yeah, well, before that, the night before, this water was incredibly refreshing, satisfying, and in the morning, it was absolutely repulsive. So he saw that in each case, his mind created reality. His mind created reality. And he realized that if you let go of this mind, everything is complete just as it is. Does that sound like anything you've heard around here before? Yeah. This is a really instructive story from the first great mind of Korean Buddhism. After this experience, he wrote a gatha, a little poem. I'm going to read it to you, and then we'll take it line by line to just look at how it connects to our own teaching. So the gatha goes like this. Because a mind arises, many kinds of dharma come into being. When this mind subsides, a sanctuary and a graveyard are not two. The three worlds are simply the mind, and all phenomena are based on consciousness. Since there is only the mind, what else is there to seek? So let's take this line by line. Because a mind arises, many kinds of dharma come into being. So this is our day-to-day mind, which is attached to our ideas, our conditioning, our hopes, our fears, our opinions. At night, Wan Hyo had found a sanctuary where he could get some sleep and quench his thirst. Right? He did. In the morning, he threw up when he saw that it was a graveyard and he had drunk from a rotting skull. So which one's the truth? If you pick either one, this, the invisible Zen stick, hits you 30 times. So opposites. Opposites. So when this mind arises, many kinds of dharma arise. Sanctuary, graveyard. Second line, when this mind subsides, a sanctuary and a graveyard are not two. This is our before, our mind before our ideas, our opinions, and karma, color, our perceptions. When this mind subsides, before our thinking turns everything into this and that. So in a very real sense, Wan Hyo's thinking did create both a sanctuary and a graveyard. We might say it was in fact a graveyard, but the night before, it also was in truth a sanctuary for him. So Wan Hyo saw that his mind created both of these separate partial realities, but neither was the whole truth. Before his thinking mind created sanctuary or graveyard, what was true? When his mind opened, everything became one, just as it is. Third line, the three worlds are simply the mind, and all phenomena are based on consciousness. Wan Hyo saw the powerful role that mind plays in creating what we think of as the truth. In the night, he was saved by the shelter and the refreshing water. In the morning, he suffered because his sanctuary had become a graveyard. Both of these points of view are delusion because they're stuck in opposites. And Wan Hyo's awakening saw through them and perceived the whole truth. So what then? Last line. Since there is only the mind, what else is there to seek? Since he saw that there was nothing else to seek outside his own mind, there was nothing special for him to seek in China. So he stayed home. No need. What he was searching for, what many monastics who traveled these great distances to experience directly through training with an enlightened master, became apparent to him. He got it, and he knew he got it. So he stayed in Korea for the rest of his life. So Wan Hyo's awakening had a profound effect both on him and both in terms of his understanding of Dharma, of the Buddhist teaching, and also in the way he conducted his personal life, which I'll get to later. First, I want to talk a little bit about Yuan Pyo's Dharma. Any questions so far? I don't want to just keep... Okay? Thoughts, comments?
Well, something did catch me when you said... So there was the sanctuary and the graveyard. And then you saw that neither were true, that he created them?
Neither were the whole truth.
Oh, right. Okay, I missed that part.
Right? We see things through our perception, and our perception colors our ideas color our perception. So we take the whole truth and our thinking mind based on our background, our conditioning, our ideas, our beliefs, our hopes, our fears, color that truth.
But it was a graveyard.
Mm-hmm. And it was a sanctuary. Was it only one or the other? Just was what it was. Yeah. So the point is, he was able to see how he created both of those and how his relationship to those moments in his lives were colored by his thinking, by mind. Yeah. Okay? All right. So let's talk about Yuan Pyo's Dharma. So from his awakening experience in the graveyard, he saw how mind makes this and that, graveyard and sanctuary, out of the unified nature of reality. He saw directly and intimately, not in an intellectual way anymore through teaching, but through his own experience, he saw that everything in the day-to-day world, on one hand, is a unified whole. Everything is interconnected. And the unified whole is equal to everything in the day-to-day world. They're two aspects of the same thing. So every day when we chant the Heart Sutra, form, emptiness does not differ from form. Form does not differ from emptiness. That's what that's pointing to. We chant that all the time. In his experience, he experienced that directly and influenced his writing for the rest of his life. We'll get to how prolific a writer he was. So Yuan Pyo spent the rest of his life writing commentaries on all of the most influential Mahayana sutras that had come in to Korea from China. And we talked a little bit about this a few minutes ago, how all of these different sutras grabbed hold in certain temples throughout this large country. What happened is these different people got different teachings out of the different sutras, and these different schools bickered with each other. Mine's the best. No, you're wrong. Mine's the best. They were all pushing to have their agenda win the day. What Yuan Pyo saw in all of these different sutras was that Buddhist thinkers had separated the wholeness of Buddhist teaching into this and that. Same thing that he did when he was in the graveyard or sanctuary. So Chinese Buddhism had fractured into a great number of schools, and these schools constantly bickered with each other over whose idea of Buddhism was the one true Buddhism. Yuan Pyo saw that each of these schools of thought were like facets of a single jewel. And through his writings, which number a couple of hundred major works, he literally made detailed commentaries on all of the sutras and all of the major teachings, and he found a way to show that if you really understood the broad, big picture of Buddhist thought, they were not inconsistent with one another. Major, major undertaking. So he synthesized the various strands of Chinese Buddhism into a cohesive whole. And he called this work The Harmonization of Disputes. That's a major, when I researched this, I couldn't comprehend what a great undertaking that is, to take all of these thoughts that had split apart and find a way to not without rationalization, but through insight, actually bring them back together again. So his work is the basis for this uniform form of Korean Buddhism that I talked about a few minutes ago, and defines our practice that comes down to us today. As a result of his work, Korean Buddhism formed its own identity, largely because of his work at the beginning. And it's not merely a stepchild of Chinese Buddhism or the greater known Japanese Buddhism. I want to now kind of flip this around and talk about how Wanyo's insights form the cornerstone of Korean Zen, which is our practice. So if you have been practicing here for some time, this should sound quite familiar to you, but I want you to see that they connect to this very early great mind. And I want you to know that everything I'm about to say is brilliantly included in our great teaching tool that Zen Master Sun San synthesized from many, many other teachers, called the Zen Circle. I know the Zen Circle is confusing to a lot of people. I think it was 2 years ago we did a workshop on the Zen Circle, which probably, the recording is probably on the members section of the website. And I think this there's a multi-page PDF that breaks the Zen Circle down a little bit more than we had a few years ago. So this is, time spent with the Zen Circle will pay off for the rest of the time you practice Zen, which I know is 10,000 years nonstop. All right, so Wanyo's insights, here I want to talk about three aspects of his teaching, and he wrote about these points constantly in his teachings. One is the two truths. I'm just going to mention them and then I'll go through them quickly. The two truths, interdependence, which I believe we talked about last year in Kilche, and a real hallmark of Korean Zen, which is an emphasis on function. Emphasis on function. So, and again, if you're newer to this, this might be a lot of stuff. You won't grasp all of it, but what I want you to take away is that connection between Wanyo and what we do here. So the two truths, we talk about the absolute world and we talk about opposites world or relative world. Wanyo referred to the two truths virtually everywhere in his writings. Just a reminder, the two truths, which absolute and relative world, first way we split the Zen circle. Our day-to-day relative world, where we're attached to karma, our karma, and attached to our thinking. The absolute world, which you can experience directly through meditation. That dissolving of separateness. Come together. They're only a teaching device because we forget about the absolute world. Right? We do. What's distinctive about Wanyo's writings is he emphasized over and over and over again the inseparability of the relationship between these two truths. They're not, and he said it in this way, that they're not two, yet not one. So they're two aspects of our existence, our experience. This is called this merging together, seamless merging together of the absolute and the relative, is called interdependence or interthinking. So that's the second point he emphasized over and over and over again. Thich Nhat Hanh calls it interbeing, that we are not separate from each other. We're not separate from anything in the whole universe. Zen Master Sung San's book of koans, the little blue one which you may have seen, is called The Whole World is a Single Flower. The whole cosmos manifests itself in everything, and everything is connected to the whole cosmos. It sounds like a paradox to our thinking mind, doesn't make logical sense, but we can directly experience it through practice. When we see that we're intimately connected to the big picture, to the whole, we can see how to function in a way that is helpful to the whole. This brings us to this emphasis on correct function. I think this is maybe the most important fruit of our practice. We don't meditate to become blissed out for the rest of our days. We don't meditate to become expert meditators. We meditate so that we can bring that practice off the cushion and connect with every part of our life. Function is really, really how we help this world. Zen Master Sung San said this about function. In our lineage, tying it together to our Kongan training, in our lineage, the point of Kongan practice is to show you how you connect your don't-know mind with everyday life. How does your meditation on the cushion find its correct function from moment to help other people? That's our practice. So when Wan Hyo stayed in Korea and wrote these 200 or so amazing writings, commentaries, by day he would do his writing, he would lecture, and by night he lived a very different kind of life. His realization that everything is interconnected meant that attachment to any particular point of view is problematic. I should start this by saying, don't try this at home. His insight was incredibly deep. He was an incredibly brilliant, eccentric character. So if you start acting like Wan Hyo did after he came back to Korea, it won't be a good thing for you. Once every few generations, maybe somebody can pull this off. But as a result, his personal life became an expression of living without any kind of boundaries. So on the one hand, he began delivering lectures and writing these extensive commentaries on all of the major sutras. But at the same time, if you wanted to find him, you could usually find him hanging out in bars and brothels, wandering the streets, singing songs to spread Buddhism to the common people. So if I forgot to mention this, he stopped being a monk after his experience. He decided that that was sequestering himself away from the whole world. So he stopped being a monk. And he started calling himself Layman of the Minor Lineage. Quite a character. And he came back, he had an affair with the local princess, bore a son, and learned to play the lute. Wandered the streets playing the lute, singing songs, bringing joy to the common people. So he was, he ruffled many, many feathers among the Orthodox monastics, and as you can imagine, he was a folk hero to the people of Korea, much, much revered to this day. So that's presentation number one. Any questions? Did that connection between his insights and the teaching that we do here, did any of that come through to you? I think that's the big takeaway. As I said last week during the first night of Kilche, when I talked about when I first started practicing, I went into a bookstore and there were all these books on Buddhism, and it wasn't until later that I found that, oh, I grabbed a Tibetan one and a Theravadan one and a mindfulness one, and happened to buy one from Zen Master Sun Tsang. But it's important for us to know what our practice is. And I think the deeper you dig, the more you find Zen resonating with your life, it really is important to kind of drill one deep hole within a tradition. You can do your practice in a number of different ways, but I know we firmly believe that at a certain point, finding the tradition that resonates with you and going at it 100% is a really helpful thing. Too much wiggle room to pop around from place to place. That's my opinion. Okay.